Mittagspause.
Hört uns denn jemand nun endlich?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it.
How will we make it?
What did you see, Clary? What did you see?
Boy.
I like to remember things my own way.
Remember me.
Reasonably unhinged.
This is correct. We are back with another reasonably unhinged movie for all you folks out there. I'm Heiner.
I'm Heddy.
And I'm Flo.
And today, yeah, three folks in the studio and one big movie to discuss. Peter Lorre's Der Verlorene, or The Lost One, from 1951. So definitely one of the earlier movies we've discussed. I'm not sure it's the oldest movie.
We recently discussed Bicycle Thief from 48.
Right, 48.
It's not that long
just
ago.
Just inched it in there, yeah. It's definitely a movie where you can see its age, and that's both, I think, a quality of the movie and, brings with it some challenging aspects as well. Eddie, you are probably can tell us a lot about. So maybe we'll just go into first impressions. You saw the movie yesterday, and it's probably very fresh on your mind. Maybe you can give us your first impression of it.
It's a good movie. I liked some aspects, we can say. For example, the narration, narrating everything from the speech of the doctor to Hosh, is it?
Yes.
He tells the entire story to Hosh.
Yes.
And that's the movie
that's
we see.
That's the narrative framing device of the movie.
Yeah, it's a really good way, we can say, to tell the story. I think it's cool. And then I also liked that sometimes you don't understand everything, but so you have to think about it. About what he is doing, what he is thinking, or things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a cool aspect when you have to think.
when the movie doesn't hold your hand all the way.
Yeah, exactly. When you have to think by yourself and not just that's it. Okay. So yeah, I like that.
Okay.
So
and what did you not like?
It's in black and white. I don't like black and white movies, firstly. Then it was a bit, sometimes what was a bit boring in some parts, I think. Mm-hmm. There was some scenes or things like that. Then maybe they were a bit slow.
Mm-hmm.
And some others were fast. They were telling you the story, you were attracted by it, and then you have these scenes where you are like, okay, but when does this scene end?
Wow, okay.
In my opinion.
I see.
And but pretty much I liked it. It was just
a challenge,
an old film. So I'm not used to them. I'm not a big fan of them, but it was a good film.
Okay.
Generally speaking, was a good film.
Okay.
So what was your first impression, Heino?
throwing
the ball back.
Exactly, because Flo recommended this movie wanted to definitely discuss this movie. And it makes a lot of sense because Peter Lorre is such a unique presence in world cinema history. He has this completely unique face and appearance that really sets him apart from all other actors, I would say, almost. And he really sort of, yeah, keeps you on your toes in his performances. So I was excited to see a new Peter Lorre performance and see what sort of mode he would be in. And it's a completely different mode from his American or pre-war Weimar era performances that I have seen thus far. Not many of them.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask, how many Peter Lorre movies did you see before?
It's a good question. I think not that many. Maybe only two or three.
Probably M?
Yes.
And
I can't tell you off the top of my head. I'd have to go into statistics and websites to exactly find that out. But the movie itself to me was a real whirlwind, because at first I was really enamored by it. At first I was completely awed by the choices and the dialogue, really, because it is a German movie, so I got to watch it in the original without subtitles. I could really easily follow the language despite it being in the sound mix. Yeah, Eddie is shaking his head as a non-native speaker in German.
We needed the English sound.
I get it. Yeah, yeah. Very understandable. it's not a great sound mix as well, to my opinion, but the dialogue itself I could follow very well. It's makes some choices, I'd say, like halfway through the movie, that really sort of confused me or really played against my previous appreciation of the film. But we'll get into that as we get deeper into the plot. But overall, yeah, it left an impression. I think that's an remarkable thing to do for a movie. It's a subject matter, post-war Germany and its citizens sort of grappling with this insane situation where some of them had previously been interned, some of them had previously done heinous crimes, and all of them have to now live together. It's an incredible scenario for a movie. So I really much appreciated seeing this kind of representation on screen, because we'll talk about that more as we go on for sure as well. Germans didn't really want to grapple with their past after the Second World War. And so this movie is also a kind of an outlier of that era. But before I go into complete monologue mode, I'd like to hear from you, Flo, who probably did the most preparation this time around, and also had the movie at home and was excited to watch it even before that. What did you think?
Yeah, I recently got hold of it on a Blu-ray, and I was very intrigued by it because I like Peter Lorre in M. I just looked up. I didn't recognize him in Maltese Falcon or anything that, but I know him from some Vincent Price, Roger Corman movies.
I think Maltese Falcon is one of the performances I've seen of his.
Yeah, probably also Casablanca, maybe, and Around the Day, World in 80 Days. He also is in that.
True.
But he plays
in some cartoons. I love his cartoon performances.
I'm
not sure if he's actually doing the performing there.
Yeah. I don't know any cartoons, but I know him from The Raven from Roger Corman, for example. Some episodic movie, Roger Corman, Vincent Price movies. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because at first I knew him from M, where he's like this child killer.
Yeah, but also predator. Conflicted child killer.
Conflicted, but he's a child killer.
Yeah.
And then I jumped to the Roger Corman movies, where he's mostly little bit bigger
guy, okay.
Drunkard, comedic relief character besides Vincent Price.
That's his mode also.
Yeah, that's... And then I was like, okay, this is the only movie he ever directed.
Yes.
So I was very intrigued.
Sort of a failed experiment by returning to Germany.
I mean, he got compared to what's the name of the man who did The Night of the Hunter?
Yes, Charles Laughton. The Night of the Hunter I also have recently seen, like one or two years ago, and I
have
think
not
this
seen it
is
yet,
an incredible film, but it's a very different film, but obvious comparison, because both of them are kind of outliers as Hollywood stars. They have very unique physiques and looks. And
they did directing, but only once, because
exactly.
critics fake and the public perception failed them.
Exactly.
Yeah. I would go along with Eddie calling it. Yeah, it is kind of a challenging movie because it has like such dark themes. Sometimes it's like it's kind of slow. Yeah, but it is very a German movie of that time, or even I think it sometimes feels older than in 1951. It feels kind of like early 40s noir film, probably because like Peter Lorre came from America where he did those movies and he watched many of them, and then he did his own take from this
but also
Jewish German perspective also on that whole thing. And I think it's very interesting. I think it was an not immaculate movie, but it like it felt like some important piece of cinema by watching it. And it has like such good pictures of it.
Yes.
It's so incredible shot. There are some shots in the movie.
Expressionism.
Yeah, his expression face, the whole black and white what's
aesthetic.
It called? Yeah, it never looks bad when somebody sits down in a good black and white movie and smokes a lot.
it's another echo of M, that we have so much smoking going on here. This was also something that M really crystallized in my head. It's like I still think about moments and scenes from M where there's like a room full of 20 people, all of them like smoking, and you can barely see through the smoke. Everyone's got a different thing, a pipe, a cigar, a cigarette, and just a thick smoke across the room. And Peter Lorre in this movie also heavily smokes.
Yeah, I mean,
almost insane.
I also had like there was a booklet to the Blu-ray, and I read the two essays about it. And one particular thing is Peter Lorre is in such unique physique in this movie, because most of the time we know him as like a little bit bigger person.
Yes, definitely.
But he just came from rehab because he had heavy drug addictions, and this is the his smallest time in his life. He was never smaller or thinner than.
You can see it.
Yeah.
He is really, because the head is still really prominent and big, but the body really doesn't support it almost.
He kind of drowns in some of this
clothes. Yes. They are almost two sizes too big. Yeah.
Because, and also, I didn't find out what he was addicted to, but it was at least tobacco, because it is mentioned that he's like...
Well, you don't go to rehab for tobacco in the 50s or in the 40s. That's the thing you do to get off the other stuff. Yeah,
but it was mentioned that he like was such a heavy smoker that he had needed help, or probably also drunk and maybe other substances.
I think so.
Yeah, but it was... Yeah, I think it was interesting that he like came from rehab, put together some sort of script, because that's also very interesting that... Apparently there wasn't like a real script. They always wrote a script, but he was on set not the easiest person.
Yeah, I can
and
imagine.
He was like sometimes throwing pages of the screenplay away we don't need this, just put it away and then do something else.
That might explain some things.
Yeah, that explains probably some things. And the other interesting thing was like they lost a rough cut of the movie, and they had to I need to check. They had to put it together again.
Yeah.
And it was a fire destroyed the cutting room along with the rough cut, which had to laboriously rebuild from 30,000 meters of negative stock.
Really, really tough production history. Yeah.
And sadly, you can see it in some sorts of the movies, or some things make more sense if you notice. Mm. But I still think it's incredibly. How good it still works.
Yes.
As a movie, it doesn't feel too much like, we lost like everything and had to rebuild it and stuff.
Actually, the plotting itself is not the worst part of the script for me, and the best part to me is the dialogue. I was really enamored by certain turns of phrases, certain decision making to the way the dialogue flowed. It felt very authentically German, very of the time, but still very clever. And it makes sense considering the people involved. There are four different authors credited for this script, and one of them is Axel Eggebrecht, who we just recently featured on the radio, because we have the Hörspiel Sommer here in Leipzig at the Richard Wagner Hain. And the Axel Eggebrecht Prize is a prize for... audio play productions that is given out every 2 years. So this year, unfortunately, we don't have it, but usually at the Hörspiel Sommer here in Leipzig, this Leipzig Prize for radio makers and audio play makers is awarded. And he is a kind of legend of German production. He's also a leftist, which is an interesting wrinkle to this. Two of the other authors, him and Peter Lorre included, are Jewish refugees from the Second World War. And yeah, that's a weird mix. It's a fascinating mix of people creating this particular movie to me, because yeah, it obviously tackles all these big subjects, but then you have points of view that are, you'd probably think, hardly antagonistic, but there's a lot of antagonistic towards the German public for what they had done to these authors, but they are very sympathetic to the post-war German plight, I would say. Don't you think?
I would not agree 100% here.
Okay, interesting. Let's get into it.
Should we start with the plot?
Yeah, we can get started. I always dread going into the plot because it gets us bogged down. But let's go through it. We have.
You want to go through it bit by bit, or just one?
No,
get it over with.
Yeah, we can get an overview of the movie so people who haven't seen get an idea of what we're talking about. Do you want to do the honors?
I could.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. We start in some. You see a sign saying Umsiedlerlager. It's a refugee camp, probably for people who were put away by the Nazis or were relocated by the Nazis, then to get them back. And Peter Lorre is a doctor there who vaccinates people, and he meets another doctor or gets introduced to another doctor, and they recognize each other. And then you learn that they both know each other from war years under different names, and they both now have new identities. And then in the evening, they go together to the canteen and drink, and then Peter Lorre just tells him the whole story, how they met, how his story is until this point. And it starts when they work together in some research facility. You never really get into what it is. It was some kind of germ research, important for the Nazis, apparently.
Yeah, vaccine creation, it seems.
Something. We never get told what it especially is.
Essential to the war effort, as other guy says.
Colonel Winkler, or you mean Hirsch?
Hirsch.
Yeah, and then there's one Colonel Winkler coming and telling Peter Lorre's Dr. Rothe that his research is getting leaked to the enemy, getting on its way through Stockholm to London.
This happens in the flashback, we have two different timelines, so to speak.
And then you just see in the flashback, it gets leaked. The other, his assistant, Dr. Hirsch, which he just met in the Now Times and under a different name, is a Gestapo officer who just is
incredible that he's both a very accomplished scientist and doctor, and then also a high-ranking Gestapo officer.
The Nazi snitch for the whole
facility. With a lot of freedom and powers, it seems.
Yeah. And he tells Colonel Winkler and Dr. Rothe that the fiancé of Peter Lorre's Dr. Rothe was giving away the information, and he found out through sleeping with her. So yes. Peter Lorre goes home, where he lives with his fiancée and her mother, and is very conflicted. You always see it's like his character's like the whole time. It's like always the guilt of the world is in his face.
Yes.
And then he, while the mother is away, he strangles his fiancée.
Yes.
He kills her, covers it up by help of Gestapo and Nazis.
He's almost passive in that. His covering up is really just sitting defeated while these Gestapo officers make the decision to, this is
just
more prudent.
Call it a suicide.
Yeah, this is more prudent for our war effort. Let's call it a suicide and be done with it.
And but he, you can see that he feels very guilty about it, and he goes on with his life. I'm just going to shortcut here a bit.
Yeah, sure.
He goes on with, you can see his struggle and how war is like just normal every day when there are sirens for air raids and stuff. And then there's one other situation where he's in a train riding around in Hamburg.
Yeah.
And then he kills again. a woman yes. while they are outside in the train, while everybody's down in the Luftschutzbunker, and he kills her. Nobody really recognizes it, but he tells as a narrator to the audience that many thousand people were killed this night because of the bombings, but he lives, but he was the only one who didn't want to live. And he also didn't want to commit yeah. those crimes. He neither wanted to kill really his fiancée nor the other woman.
Yeah,
that's what he tells yes. as narrator.
And that's maybe the biggest problem and crux for the movie for me, but let's continue and, for now.
But yeah, then he goes on how he finds out then there's something else going on in his lab.
Yes.
He knows where is a gun from the Gestapo officer, Dr. Hirsch.
Yeah, he finally cracks the drawer open that's been locked all cigarettes. This time. Yeah, and then he unravels the second identity of Hirsch to a more detailed degree.
Yeah, because he knows that he's with the Gestapo from earlier. Yeah,
from the cover-up.
And there's apparently a second big plot going on because Colonel Winkler, which just visited him, is part of some...
Conspiracy
against yes. Hitler.
Yeah.
And then there's also a whole chase scene with how he is at Colonel Winkler's home. And
which is really kind of laissez-faire security for a Hitler assassination plot. Just having a password at the door.
And apparently it's not that hidden.
No.
And yeah, he wants to kill Hirsch at this point, but he doesn't get to it. And then we jump back to the... narrating time, it's like, I think it's just like 3 years after the war. It's not that late after the war. And while they are both in the canteen drinking again, Hirsch is like very drunk. And in the end, he just shoots him as he wanted to, because that's the only person he ever really wanted to kill.
Which is the most, which is the most sort of sticky element of the film that I feel like Peter Lorre was maybe too, felt almost forced to be a murderer again, to relive the glory and also echo some stylistic elements of M. But to me, it is an ill-advised decision for this movie, because he has so much humanity in his face and we really want to empathize with the character and be more close to his actions. But then he is also just become a serial killer, which is a tough thing to defend a person doing. It's a really bold choice, and it's a kind of, to my mind, misplaced decision, because I do love the performance of Peter Lorre and his sort of guilt-ridden face, but it's defeated by him persisting in killing people, you know. I don't know what you made of this, Eddie.
Well, it seems like he also says that the only person who he really wanted to kill mm-hmm. was Hirsch. But it seems like he doesn't feel so guilty. Like he seems like pretty normal, even though like he killed two people in around like what, a week.
Yeah.
And it's like you feel like he is the bad character, but also like sympathize a bit.
Yeah.
And it's a bittersweet feeling, I can say, because you are like, why am I sympathizing with a serial killer who kills for no reason most of the times? And
it's the same kind of urge to kill that is echoed in M, where he has a similar line of he moves. And here we also have a similar kind of dialogue, him saying ich kann nicht anders oder so.
I mentioned to Eddie yesterday, I think like there were two kills on the women where like he kind of snapped because of some emotions, and the decision to kill Hirsch is like a rational decision from him to kill.
But it's even this emotionality doesn't really work, because it is this kind of almost horror Halloween style point of view that he is having this moment. He's touching the face of the woman and something snaps, something's activated in him. But this really doesn't work with the reality of the situation and the almost realist expressionism the movie usually coasts or lives on this vibe, that he has this urge to kill, but then at the same time feels this harsh remorse. I mean, it's a fascinating portrayal. You could do a interesting psychological movie on it, but to me the movie was trying to do other things than that. It wasn't really trying to go deep into the psyche of a killer, but more of the psyche of the collective German post-war mind. So having a killer as our it's both fitting and ill-advised, because it doesn't really take people into the fold.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that it makes not that much... what do you mean? Because on a personal level, if you see him as an individual, I can see the problematic, but yeah, the whole perspective as Germans as a whole, I think it makes a lot of sense that he's a stand-in for so many people. Also because like he works for the Nazis and he seems to doesn't have like... He's not that conflicted with his work. Yeah. But I think also that's like very big interpretation room, because he could also be like interpreted as a man who's just focused on his work and is so deep into science that he's like, he doesn't mind politics and everything that's happening around him.
Yes.
Because he's dug deep into it.
It seems to, the movie suggests that he's almost a science savant, that he's nonstop into this work and he's by far the best, the most capable at the work.
Also, that's like when he first kills his fiance, I think it's very subversive. Like you can read two big reasons into it why he does it. There could be like one, because he got betrayed on a professional level because she leaked his work to other people, and also like because like on the same level she betrayed him with another man.
Infidelity.
Yeah. I also think for me he killed her because she betrayed him with another man, because I think he didn't seem like a person who like minded so much that the enemy got his work, because he just was proud of his work and was so into it.
Mm. Yeah, it's just that's the big crux of the movie. I don't like each reading. Okay. They both have their struggles.
But I think if you read into the betrayal of the woman, again, I think it makes more sense why he kills the other woman, because she talks about her two children, her men in the war, and then she tries to flirt with him and tries to seduce him. And then he snaps again. So I think this whole sexual betrayal route makes much more sense.
Yeah,
for this
the
character.
Movie definitely, I think, tries to suggest this reading by having it echoed in the second kill. And also just he doesn't seem at all interested in German nationalism, in the Nazi war effort. He's not really against it, but he just doesn't seem to care before things happen to him.
Too indulged in his own work.
Definitely.
He's just like, I'm going to focus on my science, and this is everything that matters.
It seems so.
Yeah, that's one of the things I said I like about the plot in general, because at first we were like, why does he kill the woman on the train? Like, he doesn't really have a
motive.
A motive, yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you think, if you like connect all the things, you say, well, his fiance betrayed him.
Yeah.
So maybe the betrayal of the other woman, like trying to seduce him, even if she already has a husband at home, you're like, well, that's the thing that makes him like snap and kill her. So
yeah, but it's really bad to me, because it's very
That's not a good
misogynistic in general.
No,
movie,
but
unfortunately,
not the like the thing in particular, but like the way of telling the plot.
Yes,
it's like a really good plotting, I don't know.
Idea, yeah.
Yeah, because you have to think to like understand everything. You can't just like, okay, I watched the film and then that's it.
But at the same time, even understanding it leaves you with the icky feeling.
Yeah,
I feel like.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It, maybe we'll go a little back to how even the wife is introduced, because I think that's also kind of a very icky portrayal. She is immediately yelling at her doting mother that she should leave her alone. Pretty much every instance of her before she is killed is very unsympathetic. Mm. And so the movie seems to want to have it both ways, seems to want to have Peter Lorre act as a sheer response, but at the same time preparing the audience and seeing like, oh, see, this woman is kind of bad. So maybe it's not that bad. She's killed.
That's interesting, because I think the whole her yelling at her mother made her, for me, part of sympathetic, because she didn't she stood up for herself against her mother and didn't let her self get talked down by her mother, because her mother was like, shush, shush, you need to be quiet, you don't be too loud, you're a woman,
yeah,
and do everything for your man and everything. And she was like,
that is true.
She kind of stood up for herself, the fiance,
but in a very unsympathetic light, I would say. Yeah. She's not really shown as a hero for
probably
doing this.
For their,
I think the audience is supposed to react, oh, well, I think that's the intention. That is obviously, that's me reading into this, but I think 1950s audiences probably didn't
maybe
make this.
I don't know, because I read it like that. She's like, yeah, she's her own person, and she gets to be her own person, and that's probably what gets her killed.
I think at this point we don't have that much point of view, or that the mother is also kind of a bad person for being so controlling or doting. And at this point we see that both of them for the first time, and we see her immediately screaming and being extremely irritated for apparently no reason at this point. But still, yeah, there's more shades of gray to this relationship for sure.
Yeah, I would rather go for the mother and say she's like the main female character who's like very unsympathetic and like very portrayed at like very backwards and kind of like you have to be there for your man and all that traditional
It's a
picture of marriage
product of her time, and she is empathetic. She is always both trying, but she's also very alone. She's actually kind of fascinating, but she doesn't get much screen time.
I didn't find her that fascinating.
Really? No, I find it more find a character more fascinating that's so stuck in this mode, and people reacting and acting with her is an interesting.
But, yeah, she's thing. Also like. Kind of an example for many people in the movie, because there's like, she's like, I have to drive with the bus like half an hour to get some potatoes, and like for like as all Germans it were like the whole war didn't mean that much for the people in the movie. It's just like it's a backdrop and it's like some inconvenience in their personal life.
Exactly.
And not as, yeah, you have to go to the bunker when there's air raid sirens and she has to drive longer and sometimes there's no potatoes for them because, yeah, there's a shortage and stuff. And
yeah, the post-war scarcity is being shown in very delicate, very elegant ways. There's not really the into-your-face. Right, right.
The scenes we see are like midst
it's
of war.
It's 43 or something. Yeah
we... I researched some...
But also in the later parts, because the movie obviously works with flashbacks, the post-war and the pre-war are actually kind of similar, because scarcity is obviously in the latter years
of you can make a really good timeline for the movie, because there are some names mentioned, and I Googled while watching the movie, I Googled the things that happened when they mention it, like when Winkler does the whole thing that somebody got caught making an assassination attempt on Hitler. I just Googled it and was like, okay, that's like December 44. So you really know when this whole movie and all its things take place.
Yeah. It's exactly around the 45 mark where we are oscillating back and forth. Yeah. And yeah, it's a great decision to put it into those years, because as we've said, Germany after the war didn't really want to tackle its past and produced a lot of Heimatfilme, which are basically just escapism. And so this is a stark sort of contrast with the usual tenor of German cinema at that point. And also probably the reason why it didn't do well and sort of, was a negative experience overall for Peter Lorre, probably, as he tried to charter his return to German cinema and quickly had to abandon it again. But there is so much more in this movie that we have to discuss. There are so many interesting images that have stuck with me. The sets in the Lüneburger Heide really have some uniqueness to it. This internment camp where our overarching plot structure takes place is an interesting place of both kind of jovial reconciliation of people, but also just barren sadness that lingers over every corner, I felt. I don't know how you saw this environment.
Well, the camp.
Yes.
It feels like a place outside of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a really small place. You feel like the doctors itself is like in a
purgatory?
No, it's like a fine place, like a secure place.
Yeah.
So it's like you, during the film, you understand maybe a bit why he chose why he chose to be there, to like go there after changing his identity or things like that. So yeah. I think it fits very well, the plot in general, if you think about it. So
yeah, it's his nowhere that he gets to escape.
It's like like that small place that nobody knows,
but he also gets to help people.
Yeah,
I think that's a part of him, because like he did his whole research and science stuff was like something
isolated
about germs and something about like you mentioned vaccinations, and that's what he does in the camp. So he's like, I think he still is a person who wants to help people. He's a doctor that wants to help them. Also,
at the same time, he kills people.
I mean, he does. He kills individual people, but he wants to help on a bigger level, I think.
Innocent individual people.
Maybe that's one of the things that helps the viewer sympathize with with him.
Yeah, I mean,
like, also
the way
not
he
just,
handles the
people. Not just because he is a doctor, but just because
he's a good doctor.
Like even if he changed identity, he switched like a place, things like that, he still remains on his doctor career, we can say. So
Also, I think it's very interesting because the first and last image of the movie are like there's a crossing from a train, and it feels, especially the beginning, feels very like pointing index finger for people of Germany, probably, because there's like you see a train arriving in some sort of camp,
sure,
which is like that soon after World War II, just like, so people can't hide that they knew of certain things that happened, and I think evoked an image of a concentration camp.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch, I feel like, because I think the movie is already going all out in irritating or challenging its audiences at the time. That this reading, it makes sense in retrospect. I'm not sure how actually intended, but
I think it never knows. Yeah, I read that it's like that Lorre apparently knew how sinister German trains looked at that time.
I mean, they especially do look as a Jewish person, extremely sinister. Yeah, and they have a beautiful way to show this sinisterness. Like every time a train. I mean, I'm a train guy.
I remember. Panchali's.
I love trains anyway, and here we get some nice train shots, and they are sinister as hell. Yeah, I love that.
What I wanted to mention was apart from the images, and you also mentioned the dialogue, the language. I told it to Eddie yesterday when we watched the movie. I mean, you probably couldn't grasp it that much because you're not a native German speaker.
Yeah, but I like,
you recognize.
I recognize some words, some things, and you were right. Like, you hear them speaking, but it's so like an accent, quite literally, because you hear the words, you hear the dialogue, but sometimes you hear a word you have never, like, Mm-hmm. Heard in your entire life or said in an accent that when you think about it, you say, oh, this was the word. But in that accent seems like another completely...
Yeah, you can hear that the people are in and around Hamburg by how they pronounce things. I wrote down when one of the, I think it was one of the women who said, das echt shit egal.
Yeah.
Because it's
to me,
bullshit,
it all seemed normal.
Yeah, for you, it all seemed more normal. And I wanted to mention it because...
I didn't recognize any accent.
You didn't recognize the Saxony or more Görlitzy when the...
Actually, I didn't. I mean, she explicitly said she's from Görlitz, but
I think
didn't
you can hear it.
I didn't hear that much of a Saxony accent.
Not that much, but you can hear that she's not from the same region as the other people.
That's true.
And I think that's very interesting because when you go back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, German movies, they did this a lot more. Today, most of German movies are like, they're just being clean German, and when people... speak in accents or dialects, it's very pronounced and very over the top sometimes, so it feels always comedic a bit. And I just love it when just people speak their natural tongue.
I feel like Hirsch actually has more of a Rhineland or that kind of accent, because I'm very familiar with that one too. And he is, we have to talk about both of them, Winkler and Hirsch, in more detail. But also talking about dialogue, we still have to, I think, get back to the four authors of this movie, because they are an identity. Sorry,
One more thing after the shit egal thing. One other thing is when what I wanted to mention was what I think was very interesting is the choice of words for when Rothe was in a sort of pub with and found the sex worker and she wants to take him home, and then he just looks at her at her door, and I read that this was she was like completely improvising. Apparently, there was no text for her.
Really? She improvised? We haven't even talked about the word.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to go for. And Laurie told her in the bar that she should improvise. And then when they got home to her, they got to her place, air quotes, he just looked at her with such a unique way. And as you mentioned, Michael Myers, I think this is one of the scenes where the black and white is like always also... that high of a contrast that he feels like he wears a white mask.
Yes.
Just like the Michael Myers mask. And then she looks in his face and just sees his sinister, his evil in his face. And then she cries Deathbringer or Deathmaker in German. She says Todmacher.
Yeah, Deathmaker.
Before, and she screams it like 20 times before she once screams murderer.
Yeah.
And I think this was very interesting because I never heard the word Todmacher.
That's the thing. I immediately paused the movie and tried to find some linguistic background to it. It is an antiquated word, it actually being used. But funnily enough, Googling it is almost impossible because everything is overshadowed by a Götz George movie for TV that had exactly this title. And I think he plays a serial killer in this German movie. And yeah, it has this weird word because making that, it seems almost archaic. It seems like a prehistoric definition of a killer, making someone dead. It has this really removed sense to it.
Yeah, one. I think what Trove was one of the writers, right?
We have Axel Eggebrecht, the Leipzig legend. We have Helmut Keutner, and we have Benno Wigny.
Okay, now what?
Besides
then,
Peter Lorre,
One of the essays mentioned that one of the persons behind the camera was like they couldn't remember whether the unusual word Todmacher was in the script and if Laurie gave it to the woman or if he if the intensity of the improvisation caused her to come up with it herself. So like the word itself is not sure, but all the things
way
before
she brings
and
it.
Yeah, it's all improvisation.
Yeah, fascinating. But let me get into this because. Benno Wigny, the other author, is also a Jewish person who was born in France and had to live through the Third Reich in that sense. And Helmut Keutner, on the other hand, did his first movies in Nazi Germany. He was an actual director during the Nazi regime. So we have two Jewish people who obviously couldn't work in Nazi Germany and had to bear the horrors that came down on the Jewish population at the time. And we have one collaborator who, while not being an ardent supporter, still benefited from the Third Reich, which is, to me, an extremely fascinating production background that we have four creative minds, three of them victims of the regime, and one of them sort of a collaborator, you could say. It's so tough to wrap your head around to be able to collaborate with the person who, but yeah, there's so much shades of gray, right? I don't know how you think about this topic, because to me it's still an enigma to think about.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I don't even know what to think about
exactly.
It.
It's such a heady subject.
Yeah, it's weird.
At that time, probably, they didn't know as much, probably, too.
Maybe both also parties. That's the reason why the Nazo, what was his name?
Which one?
The Nazi collaborator?
Helmut Keutner.
Yeah, why he's not credited on the movie.
Oh, interesting.
So if you look online, there's only three people. It's only Egebrecht, Wigny, and Laurie as credited writers. And
so
he's the uncredited one.
Not a Jewish person, but a very leftist person who was actually in a KZ for some months for his leftist points of view. And Benno Wigny and Peter Laurie, of course, both Jewish people with, with that background, having to escape the Nazi regime. It's a fascinating collaboration, and all of them are very accomplished writers and filmmakers of their own right. So it is a fascinating collaboration, and to me, one of the biggest strengths of the movies are these certain turns of phrases, this ingenious dialogue that pops up in unexpected moments.
And the choice of words. I mean, we talked about the Todmacher and stuff. Another word which I never heard before was when the people run from the train to the bunker, they call it Heldenkeller.
Yes.
I never heard that word.
Well, I understood they were talking about the bunker because I studied that Keller is like a...
Yeah, you heard the word Keller, cellar.
But I was like, Keller, okay, it's a bunker. But why not bunker?
I don't know.
Keller is not like a bunker translation in...
No, it isn't, but they call it hero cellar. Heldenkeller is hero cellar. And I thought it was very interesting that they call the bunker hero cellar.
It's a bit of a... Also, it echoes the other one, heroes, when the people who conspire to kill Hitler talk in the room. They mention taking away some... what was it? Some substance that kills them, a suicide.
Oh, yeah, they got suicide.
I don't know if it was
pills
actually,
or something.
Probably cyanide. Probably cyanide. I'm not sure if they make it explicit, but they also have a similar term for this, the hero's death bringer or something like this.
Yeah, they talk about how if the person who got caught and then rats them out could have died in hero's death if he had this pill before.
Because I think they also mock it. They say like it's not okay. It's not okay that only the Nazis get to have this hero's death, so to speak. So they mock the Nazis for thinking that suicide is somehow a heroic thing to do, and at the same time want to assist people who probably need it for this endeavor. But they don't really lionize it in any way.
Which also brings me back to like the time where the movie or the flashback plays out is like a time where like higher ranking German officers already knew that the war is probably lost cause.
Yeah, which makes Hirsch a fascinating presence, because he is the all-in Nazi guy. He is
he's a proud
proactive
Nazi.
About this incredibly awful practice of the Gestapo of having everyone under control, and this facility he is in charge of, he really wants to be all in on everything that's happening.
I mean, when he talks about the killing of Rothe on his fiance, he just talks about it like it's a minor incident. It's just like a minor inconvenience. Okay, we had to cover up that you killed your fiance, but for the cause it's just a minor inconvenience, which makes him just such... With such a subtlety, such a cruel person.
Yes, It's that it's probably even rivals the performance of Peter Lorre, what the actor Carl John does with the Hirsch character, because he really also he doesn't have the baggage of having to be a killer and a sympathetic person at the same time. He's just the Nazi and he completely aces it. He's so over the top.
Too much fun.
He's so loud. Yeah, yes. He's always like 2 decibels louder than anyone in the room. He's brash. He's constantly irritating people and doesn't give a shit. He is.
He doesn't think about all his crimes. He is not as guilt-ridden as the Roto Lorre. He's just there drinking, having fun. It's like, look what fun times we had in the war.
Yeah.
When we had to cover up your stuff.
And the golden times for him.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we both have new identities. We get out of the allies and stuff and now can live our best lives, even though I was a goddamn full-blown Nazi criminal.
And not concerned about Lorre, about Rothe at all. He has a gun still from the previous encounters with him. He has a small gun and he constantly waves it at his face and makes allusions to using it on Hirsch. And Hirsch is not concerned in the slightest. He's like, this little doctor piece of shit, he's got no... he couldn't even operate the gun if he tried. He's not a threat to me. I'm a, I'm the Deathbringer King.
Yeah,
I'm the
guy in control. One of the interesting thing I noticed about this, like Hirsch, not noticing that the doctor is like trying to kill him. It's so obvious to the audience that you are like, how is it like?
I think he addresses it even. He says like, you really probably want to kill me, but you couldn't even use that gun if you really tried.
Yeah, that's what he does later in the movie.
Yeah, but the crazy thing is like, it seems like you have to think about how is he like, he changed the identity, he survived everything in the war. Now he is another person in another place, everything like that. And then he doesn't care if another man that did the same thing, so is as smart as him probably, is waving a gun at him. You like feel like he's stupid. It's it's a bit... Well, but he is actually a bit in like
hubristic.
He drinks. He's drinking in the scene, factor. But even at the start, he like points the gun at him while he is not drunk. So,
Had guns pointed at him a lot of times, and as a Gestapo officer, was probably kind of known for being able to assess threats. But in Rothe, he really doesn't do the job right.
Yeah, I mean, Eddie and I, we talked about after the movie that, like, in the first scene, you see the gun in the narrating frame outside of the flashback. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that he wants to use the gun and kill Hirsch.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about it. It's like, I think it's the first 10 minutes that you see how Rothe takes the gun to them drinking. And you know he will use it. You know he wants to kill Hirsch.
Yeah,
and you just have to wait 90 minutes for it to happen.
Yeah,
I think there's so much tension then build up.
Yeah, the funny thing is this, because you like have to, like the main character lets you wait 90 minutes to tell his entire story and then he kills Hirsch. That is like the cherry on top, can say, of the film. And that's the good part. The bad part is like, how isn't Hirsch noticing that he wants to kill
him? I mean, I think because he's like too sure in himself. I think it's like...
Yeah, probably that's part of his character,
I mean,
it wasn't
really a problem for me as much as him killing the woman who's innocent and he's got no connection to.
Yeah.
The Hirsch character, like even in the flashback, you can see how unconcerned he is about the gun.
Yeah.
His biggest concern is like that it makes a bulge in your pocket and bulges out the pockets of your sacco and stuff.
Multiple times he emphasizes this as a running gag in the movie.
I put it in my drawer because it ruins my my dress,
my pockets,
my clothes. So that's like his biggest concern about the gun, not that somebody uses it against him, because he feels so sure in himself and in his position of power.
One thing, another thing is about the girl who screams Deathbringer, is it?
Yeah. Todmacher.
Todmacher. I understood that. I was like, is it a real German word or is it made up?
I mean, it is, but it is not at
makes,
all.
It makes sense, but it's not a used word.
It used to be maybe a more prominent.
I also thought like it was like it's in very old words.
Oh, okay, And the funny thing is that also she is a bit of a like easy woman, we can say.
She's I mean, she's a sex worker. She's,
yeah. So like also there's on there's this guy in the flat that says, well, you have another man at your door.
We have a little flavor text for them then her neighbors all being extremely cruel and mean to her.
Yeah, but I think it's probably one of the reasons he tried, we can say he tried to kill her.
I don't know.
But if you think that he was trying to kill her, you can also see why he would have done that, because he killed the fiance for betraying, probably the train girl for betraying. He
is
a
sex
worker.
That's where the movie gets muddy. Because does it want to be a morality play on old-timey Christian values, or does it want to tackle post-war Germany and its complications? It doesn't really make enough of a comment on the on the misogyny that's at play here that I can give it the benefit of the doubt on that front, I'd say.
But I think it's, I mean, he's supposed to not be like the super sympathetic character, but I think it's still very interesting that even though he's very misogynistic by, in his killings, it's very interesting that the movie itself still paints some pictures of women and their problems, especially women, alone women with no husband or something at home in the war times. Mm. Like especially the woman he kills on the train talks about how hard it is for her.
Mm-hmm.
Alone at home with her two children.
Yeah.
So then we have the sex
but
worker.
She's not really sympathetic. Like no, she's shown as opportunistic and
kind of, but and, also but before that she's like shown as like she struggles with the whole wartime.
For sure.
And while it's for others just a minor inconvenience, or especially the Ursula Osk from Görlitz character who moves into the flat because
fascinating because she seems like a completely separate part of the film.
Yeah, I noted her down as comedic relief because she felt like that's also a thing of the movie.
She's just charming.
Also with Peter Lorre itself, some scenes feel funny with him just because how he delivers lines and how he looks.
And jokes. He has
some
jokes.
He did, he always does some jokes. Yeah, but I think Ursula is also like a character who shows like the struggles of women in World War II in Germany, because she's like alone, she had to move, she got that flat assigned from some office, and everything, like it's, I also noted down like
she is the most sympathetic person in the movie for sure
in the war.
But is she a mom?
No, not she, but the other the woman he kills.
It's tough because the movie has so many great things going for it, but at the core there is this issue to me which really I couldn't get rid of. I was really going on a roller coaster ride because my esteem of the movie grew and grew and grew as it went on, and then as the first murder happens I was like, okay, this is still like an effect thing and you can still kind of read a lot of different things into it, and I was wavering, but it was still growing my esteem. And then the second kill happens, and it really, while being cinematically very impressive with this train leaving the station and everyone evacuating and them staying on this empty train, we see outside shots of the train. It's all beautifully, beautifully produced, but it just has a really problematic accent to the story.
By the way, did you have to think about Strangers on a Train by the first murder?
A little bit, yeah.
I had to think about the party scene on Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
When like strangling is the perfect murder thing.
It seemed to be the thing to do in this era to have very close up of a person and them just being almost magically or rhythmically. Yeah,
because you never see the actual kills. You just see him moving his hands or moving towards the woman,
yes,
while also his body blocking the camera and fading to black.
Oh my goodness. As I look at the time, we already lost count and now we're at the last minute. Peter Lorre does kill himself at the end. We have to mention that too. Oh, he runs in front of a train, giving us the last train image. But that's the hour, folks.
That's the hour. Yeah. That's the nihilistic movie of this week.
Yes, it's extremely bleak. Be prepared. But I enjoyed it nonetheless, despite its flaws. So thanks for bringing it, Flo.
Yeah.
No problem.
All right.
You enjoyed it too, Eddie.
Yeah. In the end, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.